there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Yeah,
Chris.
We still make mouth sounds to drum up excitement in this show. That's where we're at.
Bam, bam, bam. Mouth bass is back, episode three something. Bam, bam, bam,
bam, bam. That's the budget we have around here. It's been very lucrative, this podcasting thing. We are dead in the middle of a series we're doing called How to Think Like a Front-End Developer, and people have been really liking this series, so I appreciate that. There's been quite a few tweets that have said that they've enjoyed kind of what we're doing here. This is, in one sense, it's a big old research project for, you know, like, let's see what this turns into. And I think it's very likely that at the end of this that we do kind of a wrap-up thing with Dave and I where we kind of reflect upon what we've learned by asking other developers this kind of a similar set of questions about just where we are at in this world of, and this, I guess, career of front-end development. Are like, are we at a crossroads, and what do other developers think? So, you know, Dave and I always have our own opinions, but it's been so great to get the opinions of other wonderful front-end developers. And we have one of those wonderful front-end developers with us today, Mr. Ben Frain. How you doing, Ben?
I'm very good, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. It's been about 5.5 years since I was last on, so it's been a while.
Yeah, we've talked to a lot of kind of repeat guests for this series. Some new, upcoming new ones too, but it's nice to catch up with folks again. So what's been going on in your life, Ben? You've got...
Well,
books.
I think last time we spoke was mainly about SaaS. So, interestingly enough, I'd done a book on SaaS back then, and I probably haven't used SaaS now for about 3 years, so I sort of don't push people towards that anymore. So I guess that's maybe something we could talk about later. So I'm still working at Bet365, which I know in the States you have a very different sort of attitude to gambling in the majority of states, but that's a very kind of complicated web app, if you like. So most of the stuff I do day-to-day is sort of very sort of finicky, complex UI, I suppose I would say.
So you work on your and is your job title front-end developer? What is it? Do you have one?
It is. The official title, yeah, is senior front-end developer. So it's...
Wow, you might be the first we've had on that actually had an official job title that involved the word front-end developer. That's good.
Well, it was funnily enough, when I joined, they kind of didn't quite know what to call it. So they said, well, yeah, what is it that you're going to be doing? And I was like, well, the proper title is front-end developer. So that's what they went with.
Well, I'll tell you, if you look around job boards, you will find this as a job title all over the place. I mean, Shop Talk Show has its own job board, and that is littered with them, of course. But anywhere you look for tech jobs, there's lots of people looking for fairly clearly front-end developers. And that's kind of part of this series is to dig into that a little bit, because I think more people are... I don't want to say upset, but like a little confused or flabbergasted or find that problematic in some way, just because of how wide that spectrum is in a way. So we'll get to that in a minute. But your job title literally is senior front-end developer. And do you kind of self-identify that way too? Do you like think of, if somebody's like, are you a front-end developer? You'd be like, heck yes.
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah.
Cool. So what, and then when you think about that word or that job title, like what is it?
I think you're right. I think these days there's such a broad spectrum of things that could encompass. And I think I like to sort of think of people. Do you have things called top trumps over there? Top trumps cards. Do you know what I mean by that?
We have a President Trump, but I'm not familiar with a Top Trump, yeah.
But not Top Trump. Well, basically, they're like it's a playing cards game here where you have a character, for example, and the character has different attributes. So it might be like, if we were doing horror characters, it would be Dracula, Scare Factor 100, Speed 60.
Okay.
That sort of thing.
Pokemon kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess so. So yeah. I like to think of people in terms of Top Trumps. So... You might say, well, I can sort of rate myself on 5 or 6 attributes that a front-end developer might have, and my set of scores is going to be different than Dave's set of scores or Chris's set of scores. And so if you're hiring somebody, you need to think about basically what set of attributes
I guess
want.
It's no wonder that you see that a lot on resumes. It's funny that a lot of people do it and then a lot of people sneer at it too. So it's kind of funny that, you know, they'll put like HTML 9 out of 10, CSS, 8 out of 10. jQuery, 10 out of 10. Sketch, 7 out of 10. That kind of thing. But you're not sneering at that. You think that's actually kind of useful way to...
Well, I'm not. I just think because we've arrived at a point where I know people who would call themselves front-end developers who would be incredible at programmatic JavaScript. But then if I said to them, can you make me that layout with Flexbox or Grid? Would just be like, no. So... You know, there's sort of, they could be so diametrically opposed, these things. Not always, but I think generally, we kind of, I always roll my eyes more when I see somebody who says they're a full stack developer, because I've never once met somebody who is truly brilliant at everything. Everybody's got an Achilles heel, you know, an area where they've not quite up to scratch. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. That's just realistically, nobody is incredible at everything. So if you're talking to people about what they want to do or what they do, I want to get an idea of, well, what do they actually like doing? Where do they want to go in the future? But also be realistic about where their skills are. And I don't think you can do that across the board and say, how good a front-end developer are you? Because you can't answer that easily.
So is there a common schism, though? Is there a divide that we see more and more? It seems like we're starting to hone in on one in this series a little bit. Brad Frost called it the front of the front and the back of the front, in a way. And then we've heard like JavaScript engineer versus like UX
UI or UX.
Well, I guess it's a sort of byproduct of the fact that a lot more applications are done with client-side JavaScript. So stuff that was traditionally done as a server technology and then just piped down rendered HTML and CSS, that stuff is happening on the client now. So we're making that weird, we're sort of compounding the two things and saying, well, just because stuff happens on the client, that makes it front end. But it really, you're just using a technology that happens on the client to deliver back end logic, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. I think it's becoming more and more clear to us that is the thing. And like, how do we start to talk about that as an industry better?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it comes down to, like, for me, I work with a lot of people who they work on what I historically have called back-end logic, because they're dealing with, you know, connecting APIs, getting stuff into the right format, pumping data through, which is the sort of stuff that I'm not strong with, you know, and I don't get actively involved in. And then they would pass that to me to deal with the stuff you see on the screen. And obviously there's overlap, but by and large, you get people who are very, very strong. This is obviously broad generalization. Get people who are incredibly strong at the back end and the logical programmatic side of things. And then you get the people who are better at the declarative languages like CSS, forming HTML well, and dealing with transferring visuals into something that actually looks like that in the browser. So they're the kind of... I don't actually think there's been much of a shift in terms of the different roles. It's just the languages and where that programmatic logic runs, if you like. So rather than a server, it's just on the front end now.
What about that handoff, though? Like, when does that happen for you? You've been at a job for a while in which that I'm sure you've seen the ins and outs of lots of that stuff. If you know where your cutoff is, and that cutoff is like, you don't necessarily fetch the data yourself, but once the data is prepared for you, then you can digest it. I think that's what you were saying there. Like, is it, I think sometimes that handoff is like, it's almost like too late. It's kind of like, well, here's the JSX, and it's like already kind of formed. And then the HTML people are like, what the flip? Or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I'm a big, big advocate of prototypes. So I like to do things whereby I'll get a very, very featured and accurate prototype that works on the, you know, front-end HTML, CSS, JavaScript. I'll typically mock up the data in terms of, you know, even if that just means making flat JSON objects and that sort of thing, to give you sort of a feel for how the data will come in and let you react to it. But for me, it's more important to, like, at the end of the day, that's what the user's going to see. So that needs to be absolutely right. And then it's a case of, well, you speak to the back-end people about that and they shape the data to fit that more so, which isn't always entirely possible, but that's the sort of direction that I like to go with things.
Dave, you think about prototyping a bunch. I wonder if that's kind of an answer here to some degree. Like, if somebody's going to do the back of the front stuff and, you know, get data together, that maybe instead of just being them just trying to piece it together into JSX or whatever this final form is, to be like, okay, well, you already have a prototype, so work from the prototype.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot, you know, let's say I'm on the front of the front, you know, this is what a wonderful kind of nomenclature we're developing. But if I'm on the front of the front, you know, what can I do to bridge the gap between the back of the front and the back end? Like what can I do to extend that? And I think if I'm hearing what kind of Ben is saying, you know, a lot of, you know, I think a lot of that logic is now happening client side through frameworks like React or Vue or Angular. So I'm just wondering, like, what superpowers can I summon to kind of make these prototypes kind of like even more full functioning production code? You know, I've done a lot of prototype, and there's this thing like prototypes don't need to be fully functioning. They should kind of exist outside of things, but how, you know, wouldn't it be cool if I could just sprinkle some salt and all of a sudden it becomes like real, you know? So I've been trying to bridge.
I've found that there's a sort of, if I'm making a front end prototype, there's elements that are very transferable to when it gets made in production. And there's bits which I know right from the outset are going to get thrown away. And what I typically find is that with backend teams, they're always very, very happy to take the HTML structure and the CSS as long as it's in an architecture that lends itself, but we'll perhaps get onto that later. What they're less likely to take is the JavaScript side of things, because that's where I'm sort of making things happen just to serve a visual purpose. You know, it tends to be more, that isn't logic they can carry to the back end because they have other concerns that I'm not privy to. I don't understand all the contexts that are going to happen. So I tend to find that it's the JavaScript things that get chucked away and rebuilt to fit the client-side JS that will happen in the real world. But almost always, as long as I've not done something terrible with the HTML and CSS, that's completely transferable. So like class names and things like that might change a little bit. But in terms of the structure and how things work, it's generally a problem that they're happy to have solved for them.
Yeah, that's actually a problem I have right now. Like developed a modal system and handed it off, rolled it into production. All of a sudden, all these needs start to happen. You know, you need this one modal to trigger another modal, and then you know, it just becomes like this like swamp sort of what the modal had to do. And so now it's just all different. And it's almost the prototype or the pattern library sort of version of the modal has diverged from the production one quite significantly. So it's now like, okay, do I upstream this? How much do I upstream? What do I upstream? Because there's all kinds of like, oh, but if it's on this page, then we kind of do this other weird thing, you know? So it's all these kind of problems you hit as like things go to
production. How do you two stand with, like, I always have a kind of debate with people with regards to coherence against consistency. Like there's often a big push where people are obsessing over designs looking consistent and pattern libraries in particular looking consistent. And my sort of feeling is more that I'm more interested in a design being coherent. And so what I mean by that is that sometimes, particularly on, you know, the more complicated an application or whatever it is that you're building becomes, the more likely it is that you want sort of subtle language differences between things to express different things. And when you try and be entirely consistent all the time, it becomes very difficult to do that. Whereas if you're going for a coherent sort of design language, then it gives you the opportunity to do that. Does that?
Well, so you're kind of saying that there's a pattern library, and I need to break it because on the choice of coherency. And I think I would never argue against that. I wouldn't say like, nope, I got to use what's in the pattern library, even at the cost of user experience to this site. Like, that would be a silly choice to make. But the fact that you're also making this choice, like, I'm going to break my porting ladder. Are you breaking it, or are you bending it, or are you manipulating? I think Ethan Marcotte recently wrote about a design system needs not only a way for people to consume it, but for things to go back into it.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, like, how badly are you breaking it? Are you breaking it with a one-off, or are you breaking it with something that could be a pattern that is useful again, or what? And so I think that's difficult, and I don't know that I'm qualified to even go there. Dave probably is more so.
I think my opinions are evolving here, but I probably am more in the consistency camp, just because what I've seen is, you know, here's a design system. Let's do it. It's in the progress of rolling out. A new design floats across the desk the next day that we all decide on the pattern library or the design system. The next day, something rolls across the desk, and it's, what is this? Oh, I saw this on gap.com, and so I kind of just riffed and, you know, copied it and whatever. And now it looks, I made another one that's based on that. And you're just like, what on earth? Like, could we not use like what we like decided on the other day? And then, you know, and that is just sort of an anecdote, but it's more like over the course of a year, 2 years or whatever, as a design system exists, like that happens a lot. You know, you onboard new designers, they have different opinions and aesthetics and styles, you know, maybe they just didn't even look at the style guide or the design system. Like, that happens a lot, or it's like trends, or like, I'm just was feeling like, you know, like, square buttons today. And you're just like, what? Like, that's not the thing.
Do you have anything there, like in terms of like a peer review for the design? Cause I found it sort of useful to have. So say that exact scenario, you would have, so let's call it a style guide rather than a system that they necessarily adhere to, but you go, this is always your starting point for everything. Like, if you want to make a modal, this is what it needs to look like. And if somebody digresses from that, then they need to explain to a peer why it's right to do that. And so they can't get it through unless it's been like peer approved, if you like.
Yeah, no, I think we typically do, but I, you know, there's always kind of rogue agencies inside the company who, you know, are like, well, guess what? We're different. We don't even need to do that. And so,
well, what if let's like we could role play it a little bit? Be like, they're like, oh, Dave, I see here that this that you've made a square button here, but really our style guide has, you know, we use round buttons on like 90% of the rest of the site. Like, did you just not know that, or what's with the square button here?
Oh, it's better.
Is it empirically better?
It's better.
It's better. Okay.
Yeah, it renders faster. It's better.
Okay. Well, okay. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying about that, but do you think then that our pattern, what direction should we go with? Should we call this a one-off button, or should we try to like morph our whole style guide into using your style of buttons? Are you willing to take on a project to replace all the buttons on the entire site with your style of buttons?
Our boss's boss said like they wanted square buttons, so I think it's kind of the most important thing.
Okay.
In the company right now.
This
yeah.
is basically everyday work
just
for everybody.
Scratch pad math here. I think, you know, replacing all of the buttons on the entire site with square buttons is going to be quite a operation. But yeah, I know we could have probably gone on with that skit for a minute, but it's like, it's hard, isn't it? Like, that's what you face, though. It isn't just like, oh, I'm sorry, I should have just made a circular button. Like, maybe that happens sometimes, but some people are just like, actually, this just looks better.
Yeah,
yeah, I kind of like my square button. Like, who cares if it's not like every other button?
To be fair, though, I think that's a big difference, though, between having good people on a team and not good people on the team. So it almost comes down to the people that you've hired. I mean, like most people that I hold in high esteem in that sort of situation, if you can say, well, they're like this for these reasons, they'll be the first people to say, oh, okay, let's do it that way then. It's the people that are less experienced that have more ego and sort of hold on to those things harder.
But you don't want people to fall over either. You don't want to be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'll make you a square button right away. Be like, no, I mean, you know, tell me why you did it at all. You know, there's kind of a probably a a baby bear answer to that.
Well, and I again, back to the evolving thing, like I wonder where there's room, the square rounded button, no one should ever debate that, but you know, is there room where you can kind of shift or alter things? I'm starting to wonder if there's a room for that, and if there's a process or a system that could support that pretty easily. So it's tough, though.
That's kind of why I ended up doing the ECSS thing, is because I'd been through a lot of, I'd looked at CSS architecture a lot. This is from sort of like 2012, and it was like my obsession for a couple of years. And I tried doing, tried scaling things every which way but loose, and I'd tried, it was around the time that OOCSS was quite popular, and then I tried doing the heavily abstracted thing, which sort of atomic CSS eventually made very popular. And where I ended up was that I found it was more important to me to be able to make these things in isolation and be able to kill them off very easily than have things which I extended with other bits and pieces. That always seemed to end me in hot water, whereas if I had a system where I could just go, okay, here's a new thing, it's its own thing, it's free to mutate and be whatever it needs to be, and it was a system of doing it where I could write it that way in prototype, just in flat files, and could still transport it across to production and there were no problems. So it was kind of born out of these exact sort of issues, if you like. And I think that is half the battle as well, is that sometimes we hold on to consistency as well because we don't have a good way of dealing with not having consistency, if that makes any sense.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Sanity. That's sanity.io, and the URL you should go to is sanity.io/shoptalk to get a free supercharged developer plan. It's kind of a fascinating app. It's like a CMS in a way. Let's say you need to build a site, and you'd like to build it on the front end with new front end technologies or old front end, whatever you want to do. Let's say you're going to host it on Netlify or something. This site's going to need some kind of back end. Like, I'd like to use something that's CMS like to power this. But it'd be kind of cool if that was just kind of hosted for me in a way that I didn't have to worry about it. Well, Sanity is a hosted back end for structured content. And it's not just their back end. It's the editor for all of your data and content that gets stored in Sanity has an editor to it as well. So it's like you can customize that. It's a React-based editor that you can customize as well. So it's like you need a backend. It's kind of cool to have a hosted backend so that you're kind of letting them deal with the scaling and structure of all that. It's kind of like a hosted CMS, but you're still building out the site in the front end however you would want to do it. So how do you get the data out of their backend? Well, they have this powerful graph-oriented query language called Grok. So it's kind of like, I need, you know, like, give me all the items with type of movie where the release date is after 2012 or something, and it'll send you back JSON of all the movies with it. You know, it's their own query language that makes that stuff really easy to get, and even like combine stuff from different tables and all that kind of different documents. It's pretty cool. They have images built in as well. So of course, great, you have structured data, that's cool, but I need, you know, multimedia stuff for my site. They have an image pipeline as part of Sanity that's super powerful, and it's not just like host my images and make them fast, but there's all kinds of stuff you can do. You can like mess with the colors and the data and get low quality image placeholders and all that stuff. It's a very powerful image pipeline that's with it, which totally makes sense to have with a hosted backend, which is great. And you know, like I mentioned, the editor also comes with unique customization capabilities that let you kind of tailor how the content is organized without having to change the content model necessarily. And so there's, you know, there's an example of all this. They made a kind of a Shop Talk Show studio example that you can spin it up. And you can spin it up on codesandbox.io, which is kind of cool. So you can kind of see like, oh, I get it. I can spin up not only the site that I'm going to build, but the CMS part of it also on my, like, just front end only, which is cool. You know, it's like this two sides of that coin. Anyway, it's cool. Sanity.io/shoptalk. Thanks. So, I mean, we knew we'd have people problems in this process. We always kind of do to some degree. And that's, you know, they're not always problems. People are the best part about our job as well, aren't they? But, you know, aside from people problems, let's get into that. Like, what's the hardest thing? What's the most part about the computer part of front-end development?
I think there's two sort of bugbears, if you like, that I used to be very passionate about getting into, like this whole thing about how to scale CSS, which I no longer want to have a conversation with anybody about, because I feel like it's basically, if you want to scale CSS, you've either got, if you imagine a line, and at one end you've got isolation, and at the other end you've got abstraction, you can scale CSS at either end of that line, and the closer you are to isolation or abstraction, the more successful your scaling will be. And you only really get problems as you start to mix and match the two techniques. And so I don't actually care how people decide to do the CSS, as long as they fundamentally understand, you know, the choices they're going
to
make.
That's a very interesting way to look at it. I hate to drag you into a conversation that you don't want to have, but as an example, if we're trying to throw technology at this, there's certainly lots of people out there that love styled components, or they love CSS modules, or they love, I can't remember them all, Glamorous, or the, you know, ones that are a little, they're in the spectrum of CSS and JS, which lend themselves toward, or view scope scales or whatever, isolation, right?
Yes.
That there's no leaking in or leaking out.
Yep.
And then if you're very consistent about that, you're going to be happy in the scaling of your style system, because it's just that will scale nicely for you. Or if you never do that and you only have, you know, utility styles, or you, I don't know, just are very abstract in your naming, that also will scale very well. And you're saying that the problem is when you kind of try to do both a little bit.
Definitely. My Han Solo speech is kind of like I've been around the world, I've seen lots of CSS architecture approaches, and there's nothing in the world that makes me believe that you can mix the two and have a successful approach. It always comes back to, it's either isolation or it's abstraction. And either of those by themselves are absolutely fine, and there's preferences.
And do you find those two sides of people like to fight about it, even though they're both right?
Well, I think part of the problem is that people haven't been able to boil it down enough to realize that that's what it comes down to, is that they, you know, you'll get some people who, they've had a mix of styles, and then they try full-on abstraction and go, oh my God, this is the best thing ever, this is how you scale CSS. And then you'll get people that have tried a mix of the two and try style components, or, you know, something like BEM, or the thing I've got, which is ECSS, and they'll go, oh my God, this is the best thing ever, this is how you scale CSS. And the truth is, either of those are fine. You only get problems when you try and mix and match the two, because they're two like competing approaches.
So scaling CSS is one of the biggest problems, but the biggest problem isn't choosing how to do it, it's screwing it up.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think we're in a position now where there's more good approaches than ever before. And as long as the one that you choose, as long as you understand the benefits and the negatives of the thing that you choose, and you go into it with your eyes open, then I think there's choices, and they'll all achieve different goals.
Well, it's interesting. It rolls us into this next one a little bit. It sounds like you've maybe like fought that war too long, and you're sick of it or bored of it or something.
Well, no, I mean, it's just I arrived on this thing that was kind of a Frankenstein system of other systems. So, you know, I took a lot of BEM, I took a bit of this, I took a bit of the other. And it just that I've arrived on something now. I've been using it for like 3 or 4 years. It runs a massive site, which doesn't have problems in that respect. So for me, for my needs, it's a solved problem. And so I'll always take a look at, you know, when I see articles pop up on newsletters that are about scaling CSS, I'm always still interested, but it never changes my opinion that there's this, you know, this line with isolation on one end, abstraction on the other, and whatever you choose is one or the other, you know, or some combination of the two. But the most successful ones, the ones that always end up working long term, are either end of that line.
Mm-hmm. And so your acronym ECSS stands for Enduring CSS. Yeah, and that's what you're saying is running your sites successfully, and you got to talk about
it. Yeah, we've got a desktop site. We have the product that I work on day to day. There's a mobile site and there's a desktop site. The mobile site is in the process of being moved over to that big parts of it are already in ECSS. The desktop site already is. But this sort of that approach was what we used there. And it's been very successful. I mean, I don't think anything that you launch at scale is ever completely plain sailing. But in terms of the typical problems that you hear from teams and developers when they're trying to scale CSS, you know, the typical ever-growing append-only style sheet, you know, and selectors, 8 or 9 selectors long, all that sort of stuff has gone. And so the stuff that I used to sort of look at the CSS and, you know, hang my head and kind of weep at, it's largely gone. So because it's a system that I can use to build the prototypes, pick up and then plop into a production environment and people can run with it there, it just means that the problems have gone, basically. So it's kind of like, there's no need to solve that problem. That's the only reason I've sort of lost interest in it a little bit.
Your approach is fairly BEM-y, I'd say, but how does it differ kind of from...
Well, the main thing that we came to and added was there was a talk by Nicholas Gallagher a few years ago where he talked about just file structure of components, and it was around the time I was looking at this sort of stuff, and that sort of clicked for me. So I took the idea that everything needs its own file, and so we namespace the CSS as well. So it's kind of hard to talk in pseudocode, but if you imagine, you know, your component like Dave's Hero image, and inside that there's a CSS file which is Dave's Hero image, and the every selector for Dave's Hero image is DHI as the namespace, and so all your selectors then hang off that namespace. And what's great about that is that provides the insulation that you can take that thing, plop it somewhere else, and we run a little tiny little JSON script which checks that the namespace hasn't already been used, which, to be honest, it barely ever happens anyway.
Unless you're being too cute or too short, yeah.
So we basically try and keep the namespaces as like a 2, 3, 4 letter namespace, and then you call the other bits pretty much what you like. And there's other rules about how you like camel case or don't camel case the bits after it, but I won't bore you with that now. But it essentially
kind of like it, because I've never bought into any particular methodology. I'm just like, come up with a name, use the name. The name is largely like a chunk of stuff, and if you need to nest a little bit within it, that's cool. But try not to get crazy with the nesting. I feel like that approach to CSS has served me on all kinds of sites, but occasionally it bites me. And if we was going to buy a methodology, I kind of like the idea that do that same thing basically, but just be a little bit more abstract with your namespacing. Like just do that, but have these unique namespace modifiers in front of all your classes.
Yeah, and it's, like I said, it's a simple thing, but it provides the same kind of insulation that you get with something like styled components, but you're doing it in a sort of a more human-friendly way, if you like, and obviously you don't need as much tooling around it. You can put tooling around it, which obviously like checks that the selectors that you're using match, you know, the selector style that we like, but it's not essential. You can, like, I can crack open and start working on a prototype straight away, name things in that manner, and then as the thing gets more and more complex, I can drop the tooling in or whatever else I need, but I don't have to chuck away all the CSS and make it in a new form. So it saves a lot of time there as well. So I think a lot of these things that are done in tooling are fantastic, you know, and I've got no complaints about how they manage it. But for me personally, for the problems I have, I like being able to do it by hand and carry it all the way through.
It looks like there's just a couple of rules. Yeah, look, it looks good. You know, it's like all of the methodologies are like name things well and kind of agree on it throughout your app.
I think you're dead right. That's like it doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. It just, you know, you want to sort of settle on something which you know is going to serve you well. And that's why, much as you said, Chris, like you've sort of settled on something which works for you. And so until you hit an actual problem, like why would you go looking for a solution?
And even that problem is a little hard to define, because it's not like I've never had a conflict. I remember just, I don't know, it was weeks, months ago or something, I picked a name for something that I thought was fine, but it turns out, just because I'm just one brain, I had used that name before. It was something like table header or something like that, or header, or who knows what it was. And it turns out I used it in one context. It was a table cell, and another one wasn't, and it caused a bunch of weird padding issue on a page. And I was like, that has bitten me in the butt. I could see that moment if it wasn't me or somebody else in a different circumstance, being like, shoot, I should have scoped that more heavily. I should have been much.
And I think, yeah, I think that only becomes a real problem depending on the complexity of what you're building. And for most people, something like ECSS is probably overkill because they're not going to get those conflicts anyway, much like you said with what you were doing. It was only in an extreme situation.
I haven't had another problem like that in months. So like having one problem like that is not, that's a baby bathwater situation.
Perhaps. Definitely, yeah.
Well, okay, well, this is fun. Let's see. Let's talk about process a little bit, just because you've worked at the same job for quite a while. I think that's kind of fascinating that the process must be good enough there that can wear on people. You know, if like your process was terrible, then maybe you would have looked for other work at some point. But it hasn't been so. Like, but even outside of the work context, what do you love? What is like an awesome project for you? And in this awesome project, you can have any role that you want. You can have any team that you want. It can be building anything that you want. But just like how do you like extract the most enjoyment out and are the most effective in a process?
I think it's I've never been in a band, but I imagine that if you can get a small team together and it feels like a band when you're making stuff, that's the best thing. So if you can get sort of slightly overlapping but mainly complementary skill sets. So, you know, you have like your front man, which is the designer or whatever, you know, you get somebody who deals more with the logic side of things, and you get somebody who deals with transferring the design into stuff inside the browser. That's the sort of team that I like. And importantly, you know, I think you need to find people that don't have ego, you know, so you need obviously good people, but I think it's important that you can put suggestions to one another and there's no kind of like rolling of the eyes and all that sort of stuff. So I like it to have probably a designer who's very focused on the visuals, somebody who's good at the application side of things, the logic perhaps. And then I'd probably sit in the middle and try and get that stuff onto the page.
So a diverse skill set kind of thing is you're interested in and you complement their skills in such a way that it literally feels like a band. I like that. Dave, are you the lead singer?
Oh, I'm the bassist. I think the bassist is the most important. Keeps the rhythm.
There you go.
A little wild card. Always.
Nobody thinks the bassist is the most important except for the bassist.
Always wants a solo.
Yeah, this analogy could run and run. I think that's the main thing that you want people who are smart and that you can learn from. I mean, I hate sort of situations where everybody's looking to you to make all the decisions. I don't think that's any sort of fun. And by the same token, I don't think it's a lot of fun if people are just dictating everything down to you either. You want to kind of feel an equal with your peers, and that's how I feel we get the best stuff made.
I think I was kind of asking about that CSS scaling thing and your kind of weariness of that in a way. Not that I keep putting that in your mouth and it's not exactly what you're saying. I get that.
That's all right.
So but maybe at one point that was a, you know, a hot topic for you and perhaps a war that you'd like to wage. We've asked other developers this, like, what's a war that you like to wage? Like, that's so important to you that you're not willing to just be like, oh, whatever they decide, I don't care. But one that you're like, no, I actually care about this. I will fight you on this one.
I think there's less, I think, than there used to be. I think part of, I can never sort of decide to myself whether it's I'm just getting tired of it and give up more easily, or I just learned to let go of things that probably aren't that important. So things like frameworks and, you know, approaches and tools and things like that. I used to sort of be quite passionate about saying, we definitely need to use this. We definitely need to use that. Whereas now I think I don't care. If it ends up on the page and it's right, that's all that really matters.
So, hiring, you must be have had some involvement with it at some point, because you're a senior front developer. Does that senior role mean that you?
Yeah. I've been involved with the hiring of a few people, and I actually think I've settled on a really good. Well, for me, it was a very good way of hiring people. So I think at first we did probably what most people do. So you put your advert out there or whatever. You get people coming in, and you do the usual. They come into the office or whatever, and you sit and talk to them. And what I found is that a lot of people could interview very well and they said all the right things. But then once they were actually on the job, you realised that, oh, God, they're actually just not that good. And so where we
interviewed well, don't work well. Fascinating.
Yeah. And so what the approach that I sort of came to was that instead of doing that, we put out a job, maybe five people get in touch. The first thing that they get is a little test. And the test is literally something as simple as there's a little sketch file or PNG or whatever you want to do with a little visual component, which is something like the stuff that you build day to day. And you say to the people, and you could pay them for this as well if you want to make up the time, but say, we estimate this is going to take, 1 to 2 hours of your time. This is the thing that we'd like you to build for us and supply us an HTML file, a CSS file, and a JavaScript file. This is what it needs to do. These are the browsers that we typically support. Think about, there'll be stuff in there which we deliberately want them to use. We'll supply the assets as well. And so, like back in the day, we would have said, this also needs to support Android 2. So we wouldn't tell them that the SVGs wouldn't work there and they'd need to switch out the PNGs and stuff like that. So you're sort of setting up traps, if you like, to put a more negative slant on it, but you're just trying to make sure that all the things that you would hope somebody would know about and care about, that they do actually cover off. And it was brilliant because what we found is that most people didn't make it through that stage. And so you weren't wasting both their time and your time having endless interviews with people, because you knew when that person finally came and walked in the door, you already knew that they could do the job, or that they were in the right ballpark. And then it's just a matter of whether you can actually get on with them or not.
Because you could say traps or customer problems, like known customer problems.
Yeah. And it's just sort of making sure that they have the same feel and care for things that you would have. So, if it's a pretty simple bit of UI and you open the CSS and all the selectors are 18 selectors long, you immediately know this isn't the person for us. So it's little things like that that you only really see when you look at somebody's code.
And are you trying to look at how they code, or did they get the right answer?
Both, I think, because it's important for me, like for the sort of front-end developer roles I was looking for at that point, I needed to make sure that somebody given a visual would code something out that looked pretty damn close to the visual.
And you'd ask them to do this. So it's not like that you went and looked at some old project of theirs and you'd be like, ooh, that's an old selector. So they're getting judged by some like old ass thing.
No, absolutely not.
This is right now. They made an 18 select. 18.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And because a typical example was that you'd look at somebody's CSS and you'd find out that they were using SAS or something like that. And they were doing that thing of putting the ampersand symbol to sort of mimic the structure of the HTML. So it's things like that which people just do and they don't understand the consequence of that. And so that's a little red flag for you that you're like, well, if they don't understand the consequence of that, they're probably not far enough along for me to be thinking about hiring them.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you are in a tough position here where, maybe that person could be educated and it's not like that's what makes hiring so hard, is because it's so personal, but yet it's not, it's one of those things like, it's cool. Like you're going to be fine. Like I'm not saying that you're a garbage developer. It's just that I have to make this choice to hire one or a very few developers. And like, I have to pass on you right now because you're just not far enough along on this journey kind of thing.
It is. And I mean, it's surprising just how many terrible developers there are though, quite honestly. And the other thing that I think was quite telling is that a lot of people just refuse to do that right off the bat, and that's also quite telling.
Oh, that's interesting. And then when you found this candidate to begin with, I would hope that, I mean, I guess, it's more interesting to hear you talk about this, but you wouldn't just put up a role that's like, hey, we're looking for a front-end developer at this job. Please apply. Because that's where this, you need to be a little bit more specific than that these days, because if it's some person whose only skill in this world is just very new school React development kind of stuff, and you've asked them to CSS a thing, well, they failed at it, and that's unfortunate, but maybe they shouldn't have applied at all because that their skill set is so off base from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've often wondered whether the people that are really strong with HTML and CSS hide in the freelancing world because in the sort of the corporate world, their skills aren't valued highly enough. Like I never cease to be amazed just how few very good HTML and CSS developers there are. And I wonder if it's because there's this kind of stigma of, well, if you're really good at HTML and CSS, you're not really a programmer. You're not really a developer. Do you know what I mean?
But they would have killed it on your test.
Oh, for sure. And they were the sort of people that we were trying to find. You know, we were trying to find people who were really strong on that sort of thing. So the advert was explicitly like, you know, we're after people who are very good at HTML, CSS. A little bit of JavaScript's great, but that's not the sort of the core of what we're after here.
Yeah. It's so tricky. I just overheard a conversation of somebody who was interviewing for a job and it was React heavy and they were feeling very positive about it. And they liked the interview process and they were asked a bunch of React questions they thought they did pretty well on. And it almost seemed like it was a sure shot. And then all right at the end, they're like, nope, you're not good enough. And the end question was something very, very specific about a fairly new React API of which they knew about, articulated why it exists and what it can do, but then got a question wrong about the actual just straight up syntax of it. And they were passed on because of that. And it just blew my mind. I was like, what kind of job? Like, you're right there. You're right at the fingertip of them being amazing. Like, I can see if somebody's like, oh, we need a React developer, and they're like, oh, I've never touched it ever. I could see passing on that person because, you know, there's a long way up from that. But if you're right at the fingertip of it to make a decision, that just blows my mind.
I mean, honestly, I've written a book about HTML and CSS and all the rest of it, and it's basically my reference guide. I must open that book up like at least once a week to look something up, because you can't hold all that stuff in your head. You know, that's why the Stack Overflow. You know, so I'm more concerned about whether people conceptually, you know, have a good feel for things. I think that's far more important than remembering syntax.
All right. Well, we have a new batch. Shop Talk Show listeners, a new batch of dribble shots. So we got a lot of good opinions about our last batch. We picked out 5 shots on dribble and asked our guest front-end developers what went through their mind right when they see it. And this is an interesting one because I know this, you know, sometimes doesn't make for good radio, although our feedback has been positive on this. So sorry about that. Well, I'll do my best to kind of describe a little bit of what these people are looking at. But of course, come to the show notes to look at the links to Dribbble to begin with.
Or check your podcatcher. It might show the image right this minute. So.
Oh, yeah, we have that cool. Thanks, Mr. Chris Enns, our podcast editor, who does these kind of rotating, like when the timestamp passes, you can change the image in there. Yeah, maybe we should try that. Ben, this isn't to, you're not supposed to like diagnose this entire design necessarily. I'm more interested in those very first reactions of like, what's going to be fun, what's going to be hard, what might be impossible-ish. Nothing's maybe truly impossible, but what's just like, why would you do that? You know, like maybe a pushback moment kind of, or a area for discussion, or what technologies does it make you think of? It could be HTML, CSS, or JavaScript. Whatever kind of comes to mind first, like what are those first few gear turns in your front-end developer mind as you look at these designs? So the first one is called Progress Board Interface for Education Platform, and it's, I don't know, I guess a little, it's a Kanban board. It looks a little Trello-esque or like a GitHub, GitLab Kanban board in a way with columns of cards, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, my first thing, I suppose, is I wonder what the scrolling pattern is here, because it looks like there's a sort of horizontal scrolling pattern maybe as you move across the boards, and so I'm thinking, well, I wonder if they want the scrolling to go left to right, maybe, rather than top to bottom. It's basically a whole bunch of essentially like media objects, which is, you know, sort of a couple of text elements with an icon to the side. You'd probably, it looks like you could do those all with a single component, with probably different attributes on. You've got different left-hand borders for those. They go top to bottom, so probably unordered lists for each of those, or maybe ordered lists, actually, because then you get you might get some ordering stuff for free for screen readers and the like. I mean, this looks like it could be a very quick to load interface as well, because everything's either text or SVG. So I have a bunch of definitions for all those SVG elements. I mean, it looks nice and clean. There's nothing there that makes me overly concerned. Interested to know when I click, there's a create new button at the bottom right of the interface, just exactly what happens there. There's that pop-up and modal. And then I'd be asking questions about, I suppose, what's the support matrix for this? Who are you looking in terms of browser support? So could we be looking at something to be built with CSS Grid? Does it need to be something a bit older? Looks like there's perhaps hover states as well on the left. So are there any affordances for large touch devices? So there's a few grayed out symbols on the left there. I want to know what happens to those on touch devices.
Okay, that's good for this one. There's a lot of stuff there that I'm sure people could relate to in a way. Let's just, we'll keep it a little bit rapid fire so we can, you know, keep your mind turning a little bit. This next one is named Tracking Dashboard for Drivers Management.
So again, this looks fairly lightweight. I mean, there's probably a Google Maps or something similar in it, like a right-hand pane and then a left-hand panel, which sort of shows you the driver that I presume is going to be taking you. There's a nice sort of graph section at the bottom with like an average line. So I wonder if that animates. Does it roll over with the mouse? Or again, what's happening with touch down there? I'd be keen to know. Whether things like there's little dots, sort of marker points on that graph, and I want to know, is there a touch target on there? And if so, what's the minimum size for that? So there's probably, although this looks sort of nice and clean at the offset, it looks like there's probably quite a bit of interaction here that needs to happen. There's a menu up by the search there, so I wonder what pops out of that or whether it modals up, whether they're going to go with system fonts here or whether there's a font face that's going to come in here, so there's that sort of stuff to consider. Again, other things like there's a little box with miles and rates per mile, stuff like that. When the page loads, does that count up or do anything fancy?
One thing I'm noticing, and maybe you're immediately wondering about the next step. Like, I think of all the guests prior, like, you're very much like, if I click that, what happens? If I click that, what happens? Is that something you find yourself doing a lot?
I suppose so, because I'm just trying to, like, the. Generally speaking, I think we're really sort of privileged at the minute with HTML and CSS in that there's not a lot layout wise that you can't immediately look at and think about how you would do it. And I'm not sort of, that's not trying to be boastful. It's just there's enough tools now in terms of layouts with things like Grid and Flex that you can look at most things and know how you would make them happen. So the stuff that I tend to be more trying to unearth at the outset is interactions and how they need to react with what you can already see on the screen. So yeah, I suppose I've not really considered that, but I suppose I do more so now.
I like that. I mean, it's taking me still some adjusting to be like layout is mostly solved and it's just fine. And even images, you know what types of images all of these are just by looking at it. You're like, oh yeah, okay, that's vector. That'll be an SVG. Like it's, those problems and issues are somewhat solved at this point. So,
I think so, yeah, because even things like, down the bottom right of this one, you've got what looks like it'd be like a JPEG or a WebP or something like that. But then you can think, well, they'll probably come in at the outset, but you could probably lazy load other ones because I imagine, you know, as you click through those, loads more are going to pop up. And things like picture set as well, which we've got now, which again, it solves a lot of problems for you. You're also thinking as well with this, like, what's it do with the screen? Very, very wide or very, very narrow? What do they imagine happening? Is this purple thing on the left, is that going to be hidden off on a menu? So you're just left with the main screen. It's permutations, I suppose, are the things that I try and think about most when I look at stuff. Like, what other states could this be in? What other sizes could it exist in?
Speaking of some kind of interactivity here, our next one is called Full Screen Hover Loop Effect. It looks like it's a dribble shot by Mary Lou from the famous Co-Drops, where it's like you mouse up to some main navigation and like the whole screen all of a sudden takes over with like a full screen where it's just showing you huge images really quickly. And then that settles down and all those pictures kind of collapse into a grid-like layout. So it's kind of a, intentionally arty effect for a photo gallery.
I mean, I have to say, I love the stuff that she does. it's nearly always crazy, and I don't know how on earth I would ever make it. So I love looking at stuff like this because it's usually stuff that I've not made before. So this is a bit of a like, oh, wow, crikey, I need to have some conversations about this. So I suppose at the outset, I'm thinking about, you've got a lot of full-scale images there, and how are we going to get those down from the from the outset, whether they're whether we're going to use something like source set and that kind of thing to get them down for different sizes, or whether you could just manage with one big highly compressed image. Do you remember there's a technique where you can get a version of an image which is double the resolution and export it at very low image quality?
Yeah, they like the 200.
I always call it the Jobsys.
Yeah, the 0% quality hack.
Yeah, that's the one. So, like, I wonder whether to keep this fast, you could do something like that, because I always worry when I see a lot of big high resolution images that this is going to crawl on a anything less than a really, really good connection. So there's considerations there about that, I think. In terms of what actually goes on and how it goes on, I'd quite honestly just have to slow all that down and get a feel for like what happens here and where does it go to. I mean, the more often you watch it, the less scary it becomes. So often I find with things like this that I tend to just have to break them down into individual bits, and usually things that have got movement going on, I'll often take a QuickTime movie of them, and then it lets me just scrub through it really slowly and get a feel for the order that things happen in. So I'd probably look to do that and then think some more about how to break that up.
Let's see. We'll move on to the fourth one here, which is named Mobile Homepage for CrowdRise by GoFundMe. So I don't know if this is turned into a real product, or it's pre-launch or already launched or just a mock-up or what, but it's specifically mobile. So as is common in a dribble shot, it's kind of like not just the design, but the design has been placed into a, it looks like kind of a iPhone X sans notch kind of phone, but it's just kind of showing you just how this design would work on a small screen, and the different screens are kind of presumably scrolled to different positions.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of it feels a little bit like the promo pages that Apple does when they launch something new, and that I could imagine that this thing, as I start to scroll, is going to have things, you know, maybe the text sort of comes in slightly from the left or the right, and it looks like there's some lovely sort of illustrations there, and I wonder whether that would be one illustration, or maybe that would be made up of three or four that actually move to provide, you know, almost like that scene comes to life in the middle of the first one. It all looks like line art, so there's no real concerns there about file size. It's all just sort of text and an SVG from what I can gather there. Perhaps speak to them and, you know, if this is something that's going to be used in poorer parts of the world, like whether they want backups for when SVG isn't available, so whether you just have a standard background in JPEG or PNG, something like that. And how they see the interactions working, where if I click get started, is it a separate page, or is that thing Ajaxed in already and the page is going to transition across? So I'd be sort of asking questions about how should this thing feel? You know, how do you want people to feel when they use this thing? Because it looks like the sort of thing that's designed to be very sort of slick and inviting. And so I think those interactions would be quite important.
Yeah, cool. So you're thinking about what's not there, which is so interesting, you know?
I think so, yeah. And I mean, if you look at that, it's nearly all, if you took away all the illustration side of this, this is all just like H tags, P tags, a button. You know, it's all very semantic HTML. There's nothing really, you know, that you'd need to overthink there, I don't think.
Right. And it looks incredibly simple, really, HTML-wise. It's what's making the party here is all these super well-crafted images.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the last one here is called Short Stash 2. And it's one of these, it's probably a website, you know, but it almost looks poster-esque in a way. There's certainly some cropping that kind of is really interesting with the word Oregon, but it's like, you know, like how do you think about that? Is that, I don't know. What we're looking at though is a kind of pretty big, I don't know if you'd call it a hero image because it's not necessarily on the top, but it's a very big image. And then a whole row of smaller images to the right of it and very gritty.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, again, whenever I see stuff with large, high-detail images, my mind immediately goes to thinking about how I can best get those down and on the page. And so I'm thinking about progressive JPEGs. I'm thinking about whether we'd use a source set, whether you'd lazy load images. Is this a panel on the right that's going to start scrolling and more images are going to come in? You've got what looks like a custom font there at the bottom right. So I'm thinking, is it just only, you know, or a set number of glyphs that they need to be in that font? Could it be an outline SVG path? So definitely the font looks like it's quite important there, because you've got something going on with it up in the top left as well, and whether that's an SVG. And then thinking about things like, does this page need to be translated or anything like that? And if it's going to be translated, does the font have the different glyphs in it for that sort of thing? And again, I want to know what happens when I click these different things. It's a nice looking site. It's just I have a lot of questions as to what this thing does.
Yeah, it doesn't seem, you know, it's like, is it a website? It is, but it's like the most like minimal and maximal at the same time. It's like, oh my God, there's nothing here. What am I looking at?
You look at it and like think, well, is it going to be one of those where the foreground of the image is going to move maybe in the background? Is going to move like a parallax effect or something like that. It seems like there's possibilities for all sorts of fun like that.
Yeah. I just don't know. That's the whole point of this, is to hear what developers like you think of these designs as we're looking at them for the very first time. So stay tuned for future episodes, folks. We'll put those in front of other developers too and see what they see, if it's the same as Ben or they see different things. Spoiler alert, it'll be different.
Stay tuned for the next episode of Shop Talk. Thank you, Ben. We'll wrap it up here. Thank you so much for coming on the show. But for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
If you go to my site, you can buy some of the books that I've written there. It's benfrain.com. I've just put a little thing on there so you can subscribe to a newsletter, so you could be maybe the second or the third person that I have on my newsletter. Only because I'm thinking I might do a beginner's book for JavaScript, so if that's something that might possibly interest you, sign up there. That's about it, really. I don't really like social media much. I'm trying to get myself off that, so don't go there.
That's a valid statement here in 2K18. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you've been enjoying this series, please tweet it out. Share it with your friends. Again, that's how people find out how to think like a front-end developer. We really appreciate you tuning in and giving your feedback. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.